Let's go. Welcome to the official Get At Me Dawg podcast. Get At Me Dawg, real rap, home of the brave, where we joke, but we don't play. Home of revolutionary masculinity, where we speak truth to power in defense of and for the furtherance of our God-given human rights. And I'm your host, Craig Maurice Broadhead. Yeah, full government. Because we don't run, we reload. Now tell them the truth, Craig. Episode 2. The title of episode 2 is... Someone Please Call 911. So it's a little after 3 a.m. and I'm flying home. We're leaving the studio because the past several days we've been leaving 6, 7 in the morning. But this night we're leaving a little bit early. It's like I said, it's only a little after 3 a.m. I'm driving. X is in the passenger seat. Our engineer Chach is behind him and Jungle is sitting behind me. And we're flying. Making good time, like, listen, we're going to get home tonight and relax a little bit early and unwind. And then way in the distance, I'm looking in the rearview mirror and I see lights flashing, but I don't even hear the sirens lit. I just see, that's how far behind they are. I just see lights way in the distance and we're flying. I mean, I'm flying. And so I look at X and everybody in the car, I'm like, yo, listen, I can make it to the ranch. Shout out to Mike from Latitude South Studio. That's where we were working out of in Leapers Fork, New York. Mike and Kath. And then shout out to Al from Poplar Studios, the Airbnb we were renting while we were there. So I'm like, yo, I can make it home. They're so far behind. But I'm like, nah, he's on federal parole for the tax evasion charge. Let me pull over. So I pull over and literally we have to wait and wait and wait for them. Probably a good 10 seconds we're waiting before they finally catch up. So an officer gets out. One approaches my side. Another officer approaches X's side. Knock on his window to roll his window down. I already started rolling my window down. You know, where you coming from? Where you going? Have you been drinking? I'm like, listen, officer, I'm just trying to get home. We've been working. I don't need a lot of commentary. I'm aware I was speeding. Just give me my ticket and we'll be about our business. So he asked for my license. I give him my license. Then he asked for everybody's license in the car. X pulls out his out because he has to comply because he's on federal parole. But Chach starts pulling his out and Jungle quick like, nah, Chach. And he tells the officer, Jungle's like, nah. He said, I'm not giving you my license and neither is he. There's no need for us to give you our license. We didn't get pulled over because we were committing a crime. You didn't pull us over because you knew we had warrants or anything. We got pulled over for a traffic stop. You only have the right to ask for his ID. The officer tried to argue a little, but eventually he knew Jungle was right. So he eventually left after a few words. He left and when Jungle stood on his rights and was like, no, you're not getting my ID. Finally, the officer left and went back to the car with me and X's license. And so we're sitting there. A few minutes go by, and all of a sudden, X's phone rings. Remember, I told you it's after 3 in the morning. His phone rings. It's his parole officer from New York. So evidently, he was notified that there was a traffic stop and X was involved in it, that Earl Simmons was involved in it. So he's small talk. Hey, how you doing? He's like, no, I'm just working. You know, we just left the studio. We on our way home, but I've been putting in that work, you know. doing what I need to do. And he's like, yeah, well, why you didn't tell me, call me, that you have police involvement? He said, because technically I don't have police involvement. I'm not the driver. We were pulled over for speeding, and we're just waiting for them to bring the ticket. He was like, okay, all right, you know. He hangs up. We're sitting there. Matter of fact, at this point, I got to backtrack now to 2 days before this call. So remember that. His parole officer calls him after, minutes after giving his license, his ID to the officer that made the stop. But 2 days before this, like I told you, we'd been coming home from 7, 8, 6, 7 in the morning and then crashing out. So 2 days before this stop, the feds, federal parole officers, showed up at the Airbnb and we were knocked out. We were sleeping. But Al, later, the owner of Poplar Studios, told us that he was outside tending to the horses and, you know, the other animals he had at the stable at the ranch. And the officers approached him and said, hey, is there Earl Simmons here? And he told him, yes, Earl Simmons stayed here and he's not causing no troubles. He's not bothering anyone. Matter of fact, they just got in. So, no, I can't go get him. I'm not waking him up. They've been working all night. Matter of fact, this is private property. It's my property. I'm the owner and I don't give you permission to be on my property. And so I guess words were exchanged, but the federal parole officers complied and began to turn and walk back towards their car. And Al, this is him telling us a story later that afternoon. He says to them, and next time you show up here, you better bring bigger guns than them little pea shooters you got, because his security got bigger guns than that. You know, so that's Al. I know they reported it to his parole officer, because later that afternoon, X woke up. He had a missed call. He calls his parole officer. He said, listen, officer showed up. They were turned away. You know, you got to comply. He said, I don't know what you're talking about, because Al didn't tell us the story till later. And he said, plus, I heard that you have guns there. That's a violation. X tells him, yeah, my man got guns, but they're all legal. And he's pressing him, are you sure? Are you sure? He said, yeah, he got paperwork. They're legal. He's not a felon. What have you. They hang up. So now I'll jump back to the police stop, because I had to give you that background. Because when they initially came to the truck, they asked for the IDs. They knew we were speeding. They didn't ask anything else. All of a sudden now, following X hanging up with his parole officer, we're sitting there, and minutes later again, finally, the original officers come back again, one on the passenger side, one on the driver's side. Now, by this time, there's 4 or 5 more police cars behind us stacked up. I look back. I see 8, 9, 10 police officers muddling, standing around. And he comes to my window and he says, are there any weapons in the truck? And I said, yes, I have weapons on my person. He said, can you please step out? I said, no problem. I get out. He ushers me to the back of the Navigator, because we were driving a black Lincoln Navigator. And I put my arms out, and I motion before he even could start patting or anything. I motion. I say, listen, be careful, because it's locked and loaded. And so he reaches into my right. I was wearing a vest, my right vest pocket. And he pulls out my 9. And he says, okay, I'm going to take out the clip, clear the chamber, and I'm going to keep this with us until we sort this all out. And he proceeds to turn around and walk back towards the other officers in the squad car. And I stop him. I said, you might want to check the other pocket. And I motioned to my left pocket. And all their eyes got big as saucers. And he hands off the 9 and the clip to one of the officers, and he turns back, comes back to me, and I said, same thing, be careful. It's locked and loaded. And so he carefully reaches into my left vest pocket, pulls out my .45, says, same thing, do you have any more weapons? So he takes out the clip. And I said, yeah, I got a hawk. I got a knife right here in my waistband. He takes that. He says, any more? And I said, no, that's it. He said, okay, thank you for being honest. And you can go back to the truck now. So I get back in the truck and we're sitting there. They keep us out there for about an hour. little over an hour, actually, you know, so they're trying to figure out whatever the situation is. Finally, and I didn't notice him this whole time, I see it on my side view mirror, the lone black officer that was there, I see him coming back, coming towards us, and I could tell he had a yellow slip, he had a ticket in his hand. So he comes up to me and he says, hey, here's your ticket, proceeds to say, you know, Franklin County, where you can answer it, what have you. And then he says, yo, they are pissed. They are pissed. They wanted to take you in. They wanted to arrest you tonight, but everything checked out. And then he says, he looks over and sees X and he says, and I'm the biggest fan, man. Like, I would love to take a picture, but they're so pissed, they'll be mad at me. I said, no problem. I had my phone in my hand. I was like, yo, just give me your number. I'll text you later. You can come to the studio one night. All right, bet. Take his number. And he says, oh, he starts to walk away. Then he says, oh, you can come retrieve your weapons. So I get out and I go back. All the officers are standing there around the first squad car. They have my guns around the hood of the car. I take my 9, put the clip in, cock it, put it in my right pocket. Take my 45, put it in my left pocket. Take my knife. Thank the officers. They don't say a word. Thank the officers. Get back in the truck, pull off and go home. My earliest childhood memories of police were positive ones because my father was a first sergeant for the county sheriff's department in mid-state New York. Not only was he my hero, but he's, of course, someone I loved and obviously respected and revered, but he also garnered respect and was revered by the community because of his character, the way he carried himself, the way he interacted with people, so much so that friends who had police contact or even were arrested by him would tell me how they respected my father so much because he treated them with dignity, with care. Even family members who had run-ins with the law said that police would be treating them poorly or approaching them aggressively, and once they discovered their last names, Broadhead, the officer would ask if they were related to First Sergeant Broadhead. And once they told them that, yeah, he's my uncle, the officer's entire demeanor would change and how they were speaking to and treating them. So that's my earliest memories of police embodied by my father. But as I got into my teens and at a very early age, I began studying Black history within the U.S., in addition to various incidents that would occur on the news regarding police shootings or police brutality or incidents even within my own family. And it began to make me question my views. Was my father the exception and not the standard for policing? Then at the age of 17, I had my own encounter with police. It wasn't violent. It wasn't brutal. It actually is a joke compared to the experiences some of us have had to endure. But it would forever change my approach and outlook concerning police. And it changed me forever because one thing I knew was this. I would never voluntarily give anyone that type of power or control over me ever again. I didn't like the feeling at all. The feeling of being powerless or losing my rights or freedoms simply just by being in handcuffs and being in the back of a police car and then in a holding cell. See, I, along with my cousin Regina and my brother Rodney and a few other family and friends, were at a pizza place on Broadway. As a matter of fact, it was called Mr. Broadway's. And Regina and I, and along with a cousin, were leaving the very next day for our freshman year of college. So we're excited to ship off and go celebrate, you know, a new city, new experience, college, you know, being away from home for the first time. So we're celebrating together and we order pizza and drinks and we're just sitting there talking and eating. And then all of a sudden, I forget which one of us, someone noticed a long hair in the pizza. And so I immediately take it and go up to the counter and show them the hair and request that the pizza be either be replaced or we're not paying for it. And the owner comes out and he accuses us of putting the hair in the pizza because we didn't want to pay for it. And clearly it's a white person's hair and no one with us has hair the length that was or the color it was, you know. Long story short, I don't know who called what, but long story short, words were exchanged, and before we knew it, police officers arrive at Mr. Broadway's, the pizza place in Kingston, and immediately, no words exchanged, no nothing, immediately put my brother and I in handcuffs, take us out to their car, and take us downtown, place us in a holding cell over hair in a pizza. We didn't assault the restaurant owner. We didn't vandalize the place. We didn't rob the place. We didn't threaten him. We didn't steal money from the register. We simply said, replace the pizza or we're not paying for it. My father obviously was alerted to the incident. And soon after, he arrived at the precinct, and I could hear him raising hell, letting the city cops know, because he was a county sheriff, he was letting the city cops know that his boys weren't criminals, that we were good kids. How dare they put handcuffs? How they arrest them? You know, eventually we're released. But on the way out, I see the restaurant owner, and he kind of says, oh, you know, I wasn't pressing charges. I don't know why they arrest you. I said, man, you're lucky my father's a cop, or I'd whoop your ass. Because it was my respect for my father that made me steer clear of trouble for fear of embarrassing him or his good name in the community. But these two white cops snatched me and my brother up. No questions, no discussions, no seeing what the story was. It's all I needed to know about some police officers. That if you're black, you are already assumed suspicious, guilty even, of something or anything. And the fact that another human being had the nerve to put their hands on me and restrict my freedom and liberty was enough for me. Never again. I vowed I would never defer to cops again. I wouldn't be disrespectful, but I will respectfully stand my ground and make sure they know they're dealing with a man, a human being. Assume nothing. I'm going to speak for me. And to this day, I live my life in a manner which I have control of me. I don't like interacting with police, judges, courts, let alone someone's jail or prison, because I don't want my life and freedom in another man's hands. So I make decisions for me. Why am I sharing this? Because my fiance often says that she finds I'm very aggressive when dealing with police. That's because I'm not ceding my rights away. I'm quick to tell them, leave me alone, go find a criminal, because I'm not the one that they're wasting taxpayer dollars by approaching me, because I'm not committing crimes. I'm not a criminal. And I say this because it's long overdue that we stop giving our children the talk. And European Americans, if you don't know what the talk is, it's the conversation that almost every single black father and every single black mother or grandmother or grandfather has with their children or grandchildren when they reach teenage years. The talk tells black kids that if they are ever confronted by police, to be overly polite, overly compliant, overly subservient and docile. Yes, sir. No, sir. Because some police behave badly and it may cost you your life. Matter of fact, when black children get their learner's permit or their driver's license, it comes with the talk. If a police officer pulls you over, put both hands on the steering wheel. Yes, sir. No, sir. Don't look them directly in the eye. Be compliant, because if you don't, you could lose your life over a simple traffic stop. That's the talk. Well, I say enough is enough of the talk, because little has changed throughout the decades. Innocent and unarmed black children, black women, and black men continue to be victims of racial profiling, police brutality, and victims of fatal police shootings. Yes, we should alert and educate our children as to the conduct of some police, but it isn't our responsibility to change them. It's their responsibility, because they chose the profession, to learn how to conduct themselves as professionals. And it's the responsibility of agencies to select people with the right character to be officers and to give them the proper training. And I led this episode off with the story about the officers in Nashville. They may have been angry. They may have wanted to arrest me. They may even have held anti-black feelings. Who knows? But they behaved and interacted with me in a professional manner. And that was black men in a tinted SUV flying down the highway, and later they found we had weapons. As opposed to the cops in Kingston, New York, who snatched up two teenagers celebrating going away to college over hair and a pizza. We need to start educating our children to stand their ground as young men and women, to demand respect with how they interact with police, to look them in their eyes, to speak with a calm, quiet, but firm confidence, to know their rights, to never back down or freely give away their rights, freedoms, liberties, or dignity as human beings. And now some would argue, like Stephen A. Smith and Shannon Sharp from First Take, which is the number one sports show in the country, that it's their platform's responsibility to help save lives. So let's listen to what they advocate.
When I get pulled over for speeding or my tint or a traffic violation, my job is to get that officer to my car, back to his car, and on his way as soon as possible. When they come to my window's already down. I already got the insurance, I got proof, I got my driver's license, I got whatever they're gonna need, I have it ready. Because I'm trying to get them to and from. And I know the longer they're there, the greater their chance is gonna be, because they're gonna be on an ego trip. Because at that point in time, they have all the power. They're really God side that road with a taser, gun, baton, mace, all of that.
My name is Craig Maurice Broadhead, and I do not approve that message. Only God is God. But let's continue.
So we know how wrong they can be. We have to make sure we don't provide any ammunition for them to be wrong. That's what I'm saying.
You know, guys, sometimes being big and black can be humiliating and degrading, because I've been pulled over, and guys were young, men and women were younger than I, and I got to say yes sir, no sir, yeah. Yes ma'am, no ma'am, because I want to go home to my kids. I want to explain. I'm not going back and forth. If you ask me, Mr. Sharp, you know how fast I was going? No, I do not. Well, you were going this fast. I'm sorry, officer, I didn't realize I was going that fast. I'll take my chances in court, but I'm gonna be able to tell my story. I don't want someone to say, I think this happened, or this is what led up to it. I'm gonna tell my side of the story. I realize at that moment, the moment he makes contact with me, he has all the power, I have none. Shannon Sharp does not matter. The money that I made, the Hall of Famer that I am, being on First Take, having my own platform, that does not matter. Because you know why? He doesn't know that. The only thing that he knows is that I'm big and black. And he feels he's at threat, he's at a risk. So to try to diffuse that and to make it as appeasing as I possibly can, I humble myself. I hand it to him, and I stay. And sometimes I'm like, bro, it's unnecessary. Yeah. I know why you stopped me, but it's okay. I'm gonna get home. I'm gonna get you on your way. On my way, and that's it.
Some of us don't have to be big. Just black is enough, and we're going to have those same experiences. And at that particular moment in time, Shannon Sharp said, yes, sir, no, sir. Guess what I do, Dom? Mm-hmm. Nothing. Windows are down. I roll. I put my hands on the steering wheel, and I give them my license, and I say nothing. If they ask me a question, I answer it. Outside that, I don't argue.
Yes.
I don't debate anything. Because the concession, and this is hard for us. We got to be real about this. The concession is the hard part for a lot of us, where you have to concede they're the ones with the power at that moment.
Yes. Right.
And so, you got to rely on the fact that, oh, I'll get you later. I'll deal with this later. But again, some people is more difficult than others to deal with that concession. That's us. So we know how wrong they can be. We have to make sure.
Completely wrong. It has nothing to do with concession. It has nothing to do with ego. It's your God-given human rights to be safe and to be respected and protected as a human being. Did you hear the shame in Shannon's voice? Did you hear the pain in his voice telling that story? Did you hear the embarrassment in his story? Hell no. No more shucking and jiving. Of course I understand their perspective. I simply reject it. Continuing to hold and propagate that same old, stale, dehumanizing perspective would be like telling the brave civil rights and Black Power warriors that they shouldn't have marched or sat in or protested because the bad behavior of some cops, they could lose their lives. And believe me, just like Stephen A. Smith and Shannon Sharp today, back then, some Black people advocated for this. Every Black person wasn't in favor of the movement, especially when it came to their town. Some discouraged their own children from getting involved. Some Black people thought MLK and others were troublemakers, rabble-rousers, causing trouble for them, bringing heat to their city and towns and neighborhoods, that it agitated the good white folks, cops and KKK. But because of those brave street soldiers who believed it was more important to demand change, to fight for their rights rather than playing it safe to make it home, today the children and grandchildren of those same naysayers and play it safe crowd, shucking and jiving, enjoy many of the rights and privilege paid for by the blood, sweat, and tears of those brave, bold, defiant social justice warriors. Enough is enough. It's 2025. Enough is enough. Police officers and those Americans who continue to hold bias, prejudice, hateful, and harmful anti-Black beliefs and feelings and energies need to be held accountable. And it's not our responsibility to appease them or to cater to their warped egos and fragile psyches. It's their responsibility to change their thinking and actions and the manner in which they view and interact with us. You see, the origins of modern-day police can be traced back in history to the formation of slave patrols. The powers that be, equipped with their racialized falsehoods, dogmas, and tropes about uncivilized Black people, convinced poor Americans that they were less human, that we were property that had to be managed, so they gave them badges and the authority to brutalize and capture runaway slaves and even violate the rights of the few free Black men during that time. These slave patrols focused their attention on areas surrounding plantations as a second line of defense for plantation owners against escape. And today, not much has changed. Law enforcement remains heavily focused on controlling and intimidating Black and other minority neighborhoods, while others go largely unchecked. And some will point to crime as the reason for this. You know, in their preconditioned, brainwashed, anti-Black minds, they believe it's because Black people are more criminal by nature. No, it has less to do with crime and more to do with an age-old system that seeks to politically dominate, economically exploit, and socially oppress Black people and other people of color. You want me to share just what I mean in more explicit detail? No problem. See, growing up, this is just a microcosm of what goes on in almost every community throughout America where policing is concerned. Excuse me. So growing up, the police beat reflected the practices of police focus and actions in Kingston, New York. It wasn't a reflection of crimes actually being committed or the types of people who committed crimes, but instead, just the bias of policing. You say, what do I mean? I'm glad you asked. So the police raids and actions and newspaper articles always seem to center on Van Buren Street, Franklin Street, Clinton Avenue, Cedar, Broadway East, Rondell Gardens. So those arrested would be Black or other people of color or poor European American so-called white people. So if one were keeping score, they would falsely lead many to believe that it's Black people and poor white people committing all the crimes, because all you see are Black faces in the police beat. But that's only if you live with your head in the sand, or you don't ever ask questions, or if you just back a system and it justifies your beliefs, your warped beliefs about Black people. But those who know, and those who knew that cops just weren't policing certain communities and establishments. Just as slave patrols focused their actions around plantations, modern day police focus largely on black and poor neighborhoods. It's well known, public knowledge even. So that means that if we knew, the police knew too, that certain restaurants, pubs, and bars, both downtown and uptown, that are frequently mainly by European Americans, so-called white businessmen and women, judges, attorneys, politicians, even police, were well-known coke dens. They were known coke users and dealers involved in community and youth or high school sports teams. But somehow, although it was and still is known to many, they never were the focus of police actions or arrests. This is not just representative of Kingston, New York. This occurs in every town and state in America. So when they parade out prison statistics, incarceration rates, crime statistics, you better know the deck is stacked. You see, I'm being nice because I could call out names of establishments and even judges and attorneys and cops who engage in such behaviors. As a matter of fact, where's the mandatory drug testing of judges and attorneys and police? They send people away to prison for years when many of them are actively social users of drugs. Where's the justice in that? The same goes for them drinking and driving and rarely being held accountable. The community is very well aware of it. And these unjust practices, agencies, and institutions only serve to inform and validate the feelings and beliefs that we hold towards police and government in general. So it's time we literally and figuratively get and keep their knee off our necks. It's time for bold leadership and actions. It's time for revolutionary thinking, planning, and movements. It's time that we are unrelenting in standing on and in defense of our human dignity, rights, freedoms, and liberties. Concede nothing. So let's go back to thoughts. Remember thoughts, actions, habits, character, destiny? What is the very first thing every politician or news channel mentions during election season when they're speaking about black voters? Crime. They always look at us as coming from crime-laden communities. Would it shock you to know that the overwhelming majority of black Americans are law-abiding citizens? Why would you be shocked? Is this accurate? Then why are we viewed as being so violent and criminal by nature? I've been trying to tell you that you got to change your anti-black mindset. You've been sold a lie passed down through the ages. They designed a system and practices and laws that have created and produced the publicized false narrative to support their anti-black tropes. They stacked the deck. The dice are rigged. And some people are just so dense that they draw conclusions from the dumbest of circumstances and factors. I worked for a few years as a youth counselor at what was viewed by some as the largest and worst facility for juvenile defenders in New York State. And not too long ago, after the guy in the White House won, a former youth aide wrote and posted on Facebook making generalizations about black people based on his observations at Brookwood Secure Center. He basically asserted that black people have problems because we're criminals, not because of racism. He thinks he's an intelligent guy, and he thinks he's a critical thinker. So how did he back up his finding, his belief? He reported that he came to this conclusion because he worked at Brookwood Secure Center and that 98% of the youth or inmates were black. So because most of the kids there were black, that justified his anti-black thinking that Brookwood Secure Center is representative of all black people. So let's explain this to him like he's a four-year-old. There were approximately 120 plus youth incarcerated at Brookwood Secure Center at the time. And let's assume that 98% were black kids. So that means about 117 kids were black. And he deduced that from this, that all black people are criminal by nature, standing in their own way for progress. So to him, 117 kids out of a population of approximately 2 million black people who live in New York City, because the majority of the kids were from the five boroughs with a few from like other cities in New York, Buffalo, Rochester, Albany mixed in, but the majority were from the five boroughs. But he assumed that the 117 youth were representative of an entire population of black people. Forget just the city where they came from, but the entirety of America. He surmised that these specific black kids who committed crimes were proof of the characteristics and tendencies of all black people. He seriously stated and offered this as an argument. Do you see how many Americans falsely read or interpret or misinterpret statistics to support their warped narrative and ways of thinking? They are delusional. And if you're one of them, you're completely delusional. I'm telling you that racism should be listed as a mental illness in America. Now, let me take this one example of statistics being wrongly interpreted to support false narratives and broaden the scope to the entirety of America. So presently in America, the total population is 340 million people that live in America. Of that, the total black population is 41.3 million people. So presently, black Americans constitute 14.4% of the total population. So let's walk this dog so I can show you something. The total U.S. prison population, that's all federal, all state, all local prisons and jails, is currently 1.8 million inmates. This is as of 2024. 1.8 million inmates in all U.S. prison populations, no matter what level. And of those 1.8 million, black inmates make up 32% of the overall prison population. See that? We are 14% of the total population, but account for 32% of the prison population due to the skewed and anti-black policing practices of departments throughout America, from small local departments all the way to large federal agencies. Whereas whites make up 31% of the overall prison population, and they comprise about 60% of the overall population currently. Hispanics make up 23% of the overall prison population. So black inmates make up 32% of the 1.8 million inmates, and that translates to about 576,000 people. So remember, I told you that there are a total of 41.3 million black people in America. And we just discovered that there are 576,000 black inmates. Can anyone tell me what percentage 576,000 is of 41.3 million? Anyone? Let me help you. It's 1.4% of all black people living in the United States. So let the actual numbers and facts settle in your brain for a minute. That's why I'm pausing. Compare and contrast these facts with your distorted impression of black people. 1.4% of all black people living in these United States are incarcerated for committing crimes, with approximately another 200,000 on some form of parole or probation. Now let's read or interpret these statistics in reverse then. That means that over 98% of all black people in these United States of America are law-abiding citizens. Let that sit for a minute, because you've been conditioned, both black and so-called white people, European Americans, to believe that we black people are criminal by nature. American politicians and the general public think we all live in crime-ridden communities and that the majority of us are prone to being criminals. The first thing, the very first thing politicians bring up when making campaign stops in black neighborhoods is crime, mass incarceration, and such. Why? Why, when over 98% of all black people are productive, law-abiding citizens, why aren't the first thing they pitch us is jobs, the economy, homeownership, entrepreneurship, business? Why is it always about crime when they speak to us? Because you've all been duped in believing the age-old black tropes, lies, falsehoods regarding black people in America. I told you last episode that you've been hoodwinked. I told you last week that you bought into the biggest lie ever told. And this administration is running the exact same play on immigrants of color as we speak. They have the MAGA as well as the undercover MAGA supporters believing that immigrants are all rapists and murderers and criminals and gang members. ICE is the new slave patrols. They're painting with the same distorted, skewed, lying, nationalistic, white supremacist brush. They take the very few immigrants who are criminals and over-exaggerate the realities and facts to stoke fear and division. They're so good at spreading the lies through media that even many black Americans think that crime is a bigger issue in our communities than it really is. And Hispanics and Latinos believing that their fellow immigrants are rapists and murderers as well, and that's why so many Latinos voted for the guy in the White House. You bought one of the oldest tricks in the book. America has been running game on everyone forever. Better learn how to think for yourself. Just a little critical thinking skills. Hone them. Learn how to read and interpret information. Learn how to dissect the world around you instead of swallowing their lies, hoaxes, witch hunts, and BS. The system is rigged. But not against the guy or guys in the White House. Not the posse of dweebs and misfits he's assembled. They're what some fake victim crying white men are calling DEI hires. This current administration, man, is rift with underqualified white males and females who are in completely over their heads. This current administration is full of underqualified white males and females who are in completely over their heads. And their latest and newest scandal over the sharing of classified information on the Signal app isn't even creating a real uproar for, isn't, and their latest and newest scandal over the sharing of classified info on the Signal app isn't even creating an uproar for the right reasons. Yes, info could have been fallen into the wrong hands, endangering the lives of soldiers, but it didn't, and hopefully they correct this practice. But what has even worse ramifications for me is that they are actively seeking to communicate in a manner that doesn't leave evidence of what they're actually doing. They're using apps like Signal because the messages are designed to disappear, leaving no trace of their discussions or actions. Why is this dangerous? There are laws requiring that all communications, government communications, be saved and archived. Remember, I shared with you last week the existence of government documents that were compiled into a book called the Counterpro Papers for the Counterintelligence Program. This book only exists because regardless of what anyone thinks about the policies or practices of past Republican or Democratic administrations, they at least followed the law and ethics of keeping official records, whether it was for historic or investigative or oversight reasons. So even when doing dirt, they honored certain codes and norms. We have a record of what officials did and said so that citizens have an opportunity to hold its government agencies and leaders accountable, so that government and its actors can be, in theory and practice, accountable to its citizens. As it is, many Americans believe that black people are exaggerating when we speak of law enforcement practices and actions within our communities. Imagine if we didn't have evidence to back it up. Hell, even with the evidence, whether written or visual, many still blame us and assert we must have done something wrong. Imagine if Americans only had the word of people they view largely as criminal by nature. So surely we must be lying or exaggerating, or we did something wrong to provoke it, because law enforcement wouldn't behave in such a manner. Blaming us for how police officers behave and act or react towards us is like blaming a woman for being raped because of what she was wearing. Well, then again, many in that crowd that's in power right now do a lot of blaming the woman too. Dress was too revealing. She was flirtatious. She let him on. Their minds are so warped, they're convinced that the perps are the victims. That's why we have so many anti-black and sexual harassers on the bench or confirmed in cabinet positions, holding offices in general. It's time to expel the old guard. It's a new day. We demand that you respect us as human beings and citizens. We demand that you speak to us as men and women. We demand that you protect and serve all within your jurisdiction with dignity. We demand that you cease racially profiling our men, women, and children. We demand that you recognize the overwhelming majority of black people are productive, law-abiding citizens. And if you cannot reject the teachings of age-old white supremacist lies and falsehoods, then stay out of our communities. Because it's already happening in some neighborhoods throughout the nation. We will form our own patrols to monitor police action, prevent the escalation of situations, and intervene in cases of gross misconduct and brutality. As citizens, we have the right to defend ourselves, especially when the government isn't. So, two episodes, and we've identified two plans of action. The first was to develop our own educational curriculum. The second one is now to form community patrols. And I will conclude this episode by revisiting what I asked last time. And please answer it honestly. Do you think the powers that be aren't intentional in how the American political, economic, social, and legal systems are designed and how they operate and why they function in the manner they do? Do you think the institutions, including media, aren't designed to support and reinforce the worst fears and inhibitions of American citizens in order to keep us divided and fearful of one another? Do you think government wants us to figure out the real culprits preventing us from becoming a more perfect union? Do you think the powers that be want a truly enlightened citizenry? How would they be able to run game on us, if we were all on one accord and were clear about their shenanigans? This is about our children and future generations. Let's continue the work. Let's do everything we can to pay it forward. Until the next time, God bless and keep the faith. Truth always comes to light. Be that light. Shout out to Juju, speedy recovery, sending all the love, all the positive energy. Our prayers to you. Set up here, running and gunning.